Okay, I just need to test the levels.
Yep, so egg, bacon, beans, fried slice, sliced, 2 cups of tea, weekend, yep. This is a mic test. Mike, what's the capital of Venezuela?
This isn't your first time.
No.
Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. Now this episode is a particularly special one. It's special because it marks the first in-person episode of this podcast since 2019. It's also special because it's the first of the 2022 Spieling the Beans Fringe Tapes, when, in August, I went up to the Edinburgh Festival, famously, of course, the place where this podcast was born, to record a bunch of new interviews for the show. And it's special because it's an episode with, quite simply, a living legend. My guest today is perhaps best known for being one of the central misanthropes on the long-running BBC series Grumpy Old Men. But to list him only as such would be to overlook his decades of magnificence as one of the most creative and reinventive comedic artists that the Fringe and British comedy in general has ever seen. His Dada-esque creations have been the stuff of festival legend, and his BBC comedy work, from QI to Just a Minute, have seen him become one of the most familiar and recognisable voices of the broadcaster. And this is not even to mention him being a vociferous poetry enthusiast and a renowned poet himself. Over the course of our 45-minute chat, we cover the big five: Shakespeare, socks, surrealism, schooling, and seafood, and so much more. So let's get straight to it. Please welcome my guest for this episode, Arthur Smith. Arthur Smith, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, I'm pleased to be here, Dom. Groovy little place you got here in the grass market.
Thank you very much.
I like the grass market.
It's nice.
Do you know what? I really fancy some oysters. Why are they getting them in the grass market? Anyway, if anyone knows that, please write in or send me some oysters.
Lobster up near the assembly rooms out of the van, which feels
brave. If they
do
lobster, maybe they'll do oysters. They often go together, the two of them. Although probably lobsters eat oysters. No, I don't know. Well, let's move on.
Are they carnivorous lobsters? I never really...
Yeah, I don't know. What do lobsters eat?
These are the questions for John Lloyd.
Yeah, do ask him. He should know that. On QI, you'd know that.
I feel so. You weren't on the L series then for lobsters?
No, I missed that one. I must have been away for that one, yeah.
Probably doing one of the fringes, because you're here, of course,
my 75 years at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Absolutely, so called, because it marks your 45th anniversary of the Fringe.
Technically, but my point being that for young people who can't really tell how old people are, maybe I have been here for 75 years, you know, because, you know, for people who've never had sex under a Labour government, I'm so unimaginably old that I could have been here for 75 years. But, yeah, it's actually 45 since I first came up.
Yeah. What do you remember about that 1977 Fringe?
Well, it was just so exciting. We didn't really know what to expect, but we got here and there was a real buzz, and we had 3 days before we were starting. We were staying with my brother and his girlfriend. So we had somewhere to stay, and we went out, you know, flyering and getting, sticking up posters and blagging people and doing silly acts on top of statues and generally going mad to publicise the show. And then on the first night, there were three people. Well, there were three. There was my brother, his girlfriend, and their dog. Was all we had. But that's classic Fringe, isn't it? But then we kind of kept carried on and on and on. And eventually, on the very last night, we sold out. Fantastic. And it was just so exciting. And I actually remember I actually copped off with a woman that night.
Congratulations.
Yeah, and which was... and she later became a nun, I discovered. Really?
Did you take it personally?
Well, I only found out about 3 years later, and it was only really a one-night stand. So I've had a one-night stand with a nun, You there don't. You I mean, she wasn't a nun at the time, I presume, but, you know, that's that was one of the many things that have happened to me over the years at the Edinburgh Fringe that stays warmly in my heart. I had a thing which was the mantra of the performer is, I'll get drunk, I'll get laid, I'll get spotted, I'll get paid. And in the end, over the years, I've managed all of those.
It's the greatest I Spy game of them all.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, so many acts and so many people. It's so exciting to be that it's back going again, yeah, and going and watching, you know, seeing new young acts. I quite like to just wander along and then I happen to pass any venue and it's got a show starting in 5 minutes. I'll just go in and see it, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I've seen some real shit ones.
What's been the shittest you've seen?
Well, there was the great Malcolm Hardy, who urinated over the front row and just sort of stood there naked for a while. Although he was right, you know, I loved Malcolm and you could forgive him for that. Oh, let me think. I remember going to see a play. It was an Ibsen play called When We Dead Awaken, quite an obscure play of Ibsen's, and I realised why it was obscure when I was watching it. And I had a friend of mine in it, and he said at one point, his character said, look, here comes the hunter. And then there was a very, very long pause. Nothing happened, and then he repeated again, look, here comes the hunter. And it turned out that the hunter had had enough of this play and got the train back to London. So the whole play just sort of stopped at that point because the hunter was one of the principal characters in it. So it was all, that was a bit of a disaster. I remember going to, No, someone told me about it. There was a show and he had two people in the audience and they both left after 5 minutes. And I felt really sorry for that performer. Mind you, it was quite brave of the people to leave, given they were only two in the audience. I mean, most shows, when they acts when they start out, have, you know, no one in the audience, really. It's well known. You know, I think the average audience is only 11 or something. Or I remember reading that statistic, something like that, once. But then eventually you get a bit better known and, you know, or you get a PR person and then these days there's all, you know, Instagram and TikTok, so anyone can publicise them themselves in a way.
Yeah. Are you on TikTok?
No. I'm sort of on it, but I couldn't really get into it. I'm just too old for TikTok, really, I think. I don't really understand it. Also, I'm slightly afraid that the Chinese are finding out everything about me.
I get that too. It seems like there was a big, like, Guardian story dumped about that, and everyone's just forgotten about that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's something faintly suspicious about it, and I kind of feel like I'm too old to be an influencer. And, yeah, my joke used to be, Instagram, I thought, was just a really efficient drug dealer.
I get what you mean. I mean, I'm 26, I feel too old for it. So.
Blimey. Well, then, I don't feel need to feel too guilty about it.
That, or it goes round full circle and you'll be the next Addison Rae, which, I knew as a reference, you weren't going to get.
Yeah.
By the very nature of the setup.
No idea. I've heard the name. Who's Addison Rae?
I think she's an influencer. I might be getting the name wrong.
Yeah.
But
you can't be an influencer at my age, or only in a very different sort of a way.
Which we don't have the time to go into.
No.
What's been the most noticeable difference you've seen from 1977 to 2022?
Well, it's much bigger, of course. Mm-hmm. It was pretty big then, but there were only, I don't know, 40 or 50 comedy acts on, I remember, when we first came. And mostly then, they were reviews, as they were known, which we now probably call sketch shows. And a lot of them were like I was. We were a university review that had decided to come up to Edinburgh.
Hmm.
There was no stand-ups then at all, really. Stand-up didn't really start till early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, now there's no reviews. There's a few sketch shows, but there's just a million stand-ups, aren't there?
Yeah.
So that's one of many things that's changed, but it's still essentially the same. And it's a great playground of the imagination, a kind of orgy of experimentation. And these days I don't go out every night drinking and chasing women and whatnot. I'm much more sedentary these days. I'm usually in bed by midnight. I hope you've been out giving it some stick, have you?
I was heading to bed about 5 this morning.
Ah, that's excellent. That's so, well done. Yeah, my techie, who's conveniently called Becky, Becky the techie, has been back at 4:30 a.m. the last 2 nights, she informed me, and I applauded her and said, well done.
That explains the mic falling off the other night.
Oh, yeah. Were you there?
I was there yesterday.
Ah, yeah, oh, when the mic, oh, God, yeah, oh, there was a real techie nightmare, wasn't it? Yeah, when the mic stopped working, fell off me face, and then, yeah, well, I mean, these things happen. That's part of the nature of the event, but I kind of got away with it, I think, did I?
Oh, totally, yeah. I was going to reference it later on, but since it came up naturally, you've written a lot about your father, Sid.
Yeah.
Who was an amazing man by all accounts. Prisoner of war, captured in Colditz, then became a police officer for South London.
Yeah.
A fantastic man. And you write in your memoir, My Name is Daisy Fairfax.
Daphne Fairfax, yeah.
My apologies.
Well done, Dom. You've done your homework, though.
Oh, the IRS are very interested in that. But you write about that about a moment, and correct me if I get it wrong, but you're a young kid. And you're walking on with him on the beat.
Yeah.
And a couple of guys come over and go, "Hey, Sid, how you doing? Sid, oh, great to see you, Sid." And you immediately think, oh, they must be friends or colleagues. Yeah. And they were people he'd locked up.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Oh, he became a jailer, essentially, at Kennington Police Station. And it was his job to look after the guys who'd been arrested overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But because he had been a prisoner himself, he never, you know, he had a great sympathy for the prisoners themselves, so he was really nice to them.
Mm.
And, you know, he never really liked arresting anyone when he was on the beat. So, yeah, he was really popular with the prisoners, which I thought is a fitting, a great tribute. I don't think many prisoners like their jailers very much.
No, not unless Stockholm Syndrome sets in.
Yeah, but there was also, because he... as a child, he had, this wasn't in that show, I'm not sure even if it was in my memoir, but his dad had been in, protection, royal protection type thing, and had been looked after Haile Selassie, who was the emperor of Ethiopia, and who'd briefly, you know, he had to leave Ethiopia, and then he went back after the war, but was being looked after by the British security, who was my granddad. And then he was apparently, Haile was quite nice and got on with my granddad and invited my granddad to bring his sons to have lunch with him in this posh hotel where he was hiding out. And so my dad at the age of 10 or 11 met Haile Selassie, and then years later, when he was a jailer and there were a lot of Rasta guys getting nicked for smoking grass and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But he always used to say to him, "Hey, I met Haile Selassie," and they were so, they were really impressed by him. my granddad met Haile Selassie. Well, my dad did too, yeah.
Well, I imagine they're quite glad to be, the weed smokers were quite happy to be jailed there. Because
absolutely,
you could find out all the stories, the anecdotes.
Well, I've never quite got the connection between the Rasta men and Haile Selassie, but obviously, he was like the king of Rastas, wasn't he?
It would seem so, from their reaction.
Yeah.
They've heard of him for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned that in part in connection with the mic issues of last night, because I noticed was what I really admired was the kindness with which you treated the techies about the failure.
Oh, yeah.
Because other performers would have sort of thought, like, I'm entirely within my rights to get pissed off with them. Like,
yeah.
They should have stuck the tape on, etc.
Well, I think that's something I've learned over the years that actually, you know, they're just as important as me. I'm no more or less important than the techie people.
Mm.
And so I always try and treat them well. I don't think I did so much, you know, 20 years ago when I was a bit of a, you know, bit of an arrogant twat in a way. But these days, I'm not going to blame it on them. They didn't mean it, did they, for me microphone to fall off and the light not to be on. And I mean, there was the odd cock-up, but it wasn't really. I mean, certainly they didn't mean it. That's the main thing in these matters. And so, it was nice. Yeah, and the guy came up on stage and helped me try and mend it.
He did Luke, I remember.
Luke, that's right, lovely Luke, yeah. And I got him a round of applause and everything, yeah.
Yeah, he was a main character of the show by the end.
Yeah, you're right, I should have brought him on at the end with the naked lady.
What was the conversation with the naked lady to go, I've got this idea?
Well, it happened years ago. Because it's not the first time, I should explain to anyone listening, there's a point in my show when, for no apparent reason, a naked woman walks across the back of the stage, and I kind of pretend not to see her. And, Marissa Burgess, she's a critic, and she also works as a life model. So she... And I think it was her who suggested it to me. So I said, do you want me to just sort of come on naked? I said, oh, yeah, all right. And I first used her. I can't remember when the first time was. I've used her a couple of times in this thing, just arbitrarily a naked woman walking across the back of the stage. Obviously, is entertaining.
Sure.
I had a naked man once come on at the end as well in a different show I did, dressed as, what was he wearing? A Donald Trump mask or something. I can't really remember what it was all about now.
Visual
yeah.
image to...
Yeah, I agree. No, I don't think that was a last resort because it was meant to be someone else, but then, anyway, it's a long story.
Okay, so she pitched herself to you rather than...
Yeah. I was, yeah. Oh, I can't remember. Or it was a sort of mutual thing because I knew her anyway because she writes reviews and she's been around the comedy scene for a long time.
Sure.
And I said, well, maybe she can't. Yeah, and she told me she was a life model. So I said, oh, yeah, well, maybe come. And she said, yeah, okay. Yeah, it's great. And it's a little gag I've put in a couple of times over the years.
And it was lovely because how you connected it with the Lady Godiva or Lady Chatterley's.
Yes, Lady McChatterley. This was something that happened in the early days of the Fringe when a naked woman walked. It was part of the show. She walked across the stage at the McEwan Hall, but then this is must have been the 60s or early, it was a big scandal and there was a court case which became known as the Lady McChatterley trial. And I mean having read about this, I thought that's what made me think, oh yeah, I'll have Marissa in it again, but I'll mention this and then she can come on. And so that was one of the many scandals of the Fringe over the years. I speak as a man who's got arrested, obviously.
Yes, remind us what you were...
Yes, well, I do these late-night tours of the Royal Mile, and the next one's this Saturday the 11th, is it? At 2 a.m. At the entrance to the castle.
I'll come along.
Yeah, and I mean, they're not quite so wild these days, because I'm not drunk all the time, and, and you know, there's only, only get sort of 30 or 40 at that time in the morning, but in the old days, I had 100 or 200 sometimes, and I had a megaphone, and... this character, Malcolm Hardy, who I mentioned, used to call the police always at the start of it. Said, oh, look, there's a bit of trouble here. And then I ended up getting arrested for breach of the peace and possession of a megaphone. And Simon Munnery was also arrested. And I gather he's doing bits about it. He's talking about that in the show he's got here this year, which unfortunately I can't see because it's on about the same time as me. But I'm quite proud of getting arrested at the end of a gig. It's not many of us could say that.
No, and you're well known for your high high concept approach to shows. The one where you're starting at the top of you timed ballet dances at the top of the mountain.
You know about that one? Yeah.
Well, I've done my homework.
You really have. I did an outdoor show, yeah. And it was supposed to be Swan Lake. And I mean, it was really just me walking around with all sorts of people popping out of bushes and doing ridiculous things. And it ended, I recited this rather beautiful poem I sometimes do. And I had six ballet dancers set up on Salisbury Crags about, half a mile behind and up from where I was standing, me and the audience were standing. And then they suddenly appeared and I pointed them out. And they did a ballet dance. And then I had a false one that fell down the hill, apparently. But yeah, I think I often think that must be the longest range joke there's been at the Fringe, maybe, because, they were a real long distance away.
Sure.
From where we were standing. Yeah, I mean, that's one of many ridiculous moments I've had over the years in Edinburgh.
Well, someone has copied your idea. In the sense that Sir Ian McKellen is currently at the Fringe performing Hamlet, which I believe is just a direct takeoff of your Hamlet.
Yeah, you're right. I'm going to go around and beat Ian McKellen. No, I think that's a dance version of Hamlet, but he's standing there doing a few of the actual soliloquies from Hamlet.
Sure.
And a little bit of dance. Yeah, someone I know went to see it and... Well, you know, 2 stars, right? That's what they suggested.
Really?
Yeah. Although he's great. I mean, he's a wonderful performer of Shakespeare, obviously, though not as good as me.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I've been ripped off by Ian McKellen, but fair enough.
And your Hamlet, quite a lot of sort of trivia attached to your Hamlet, because you had Sally Phillips as Ophelia.
Yeah.
Famously referenced in, I think, Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast that... He was the influence behind her ire.
Yeah, because I'd said to Sally, right, you just come on as Ophelia and you just rant about anything that's really annoying you at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd had a little thing with Richard Herring
mm-hmm.
that had gone wrong. I don't know the ins and outs of it. But and so she wanted to rant about him. And I said, well, I don't know, but at least change his name. So we called him Dick Kipper. Which I think probably people might have guessed who it was. And she came on and ranted about what a bastard he was. Yeah, which, and then I remember he came to see the show. It was all a little bit embarrassing. But I think, you know, Sally recovered from her heartbreak and she's doing great now. And I'm pleased to see it. And so's Richard Herring, obviously.
Everyone came out well from that.
Yeah, you're right.
And your interpretation is based on... Mad Frankie Fraser?
Oh, yeah. The Mad Frankie Fraser, a gangster, and man who used to beat up and kill people for money for the Crays and the Richardsons and whatnot, and spent 37 years in prison. And he had a book out at the time, which was mainly just about who he'd beaten up over the years.
Just a confession.
Yeah, and and I took him out for lunch. He said, hello, Arthur. You know, he made me sound like Prince Charles. And he said, well, what you got me here for then? And I said, well, I'm doing Hamlet. He said, well, you pay for lunch. I'll do him for you if you like. And, of course, you know, Hamlet, who couldn't bring himself to take revenge on his uncle who'd killed Hamlet's dad and married his mum. And I was like, well, Mad Frankie Fraser wouldn't really have much problem with... with overcoming that, and would have just shot Claudius in the first 30 seconds of the show. Play would have been a lot shorter, but I thought it was an interesting reference, yeah. And he came to see the show, actually.
Oh, wow.
I know, we were all a bit nervous because I was slightly taking the piss out of him, but you know, he seemed to be all right with it, yeah.
Was it the same show Richard Herring was there? Because that's an interesting tension going
on. Yeah, bloody hell. I can't remember, but let's say it was, yeah.
Yeah, why not? We can create the law now.
Yeah.
Amazing. I've got in my notes, I just have the word socks.
Yes.
So let's talk about socks, baby.
Yeah. I know, there's not enough people talk about socks. I love socks. And I'm an odd socks man. Although, today, I'm disappointed to see they nearly match my socks.
Well, I have gone with odd socks.
Well done.
Specifically for this interview.
Yeah, well, I'll do my little poem then. I've got 47 socks, including 11 pairs. Lovers, come and wear my socks, move on and leave me theirs. Here's a red sock, for example, belonging once to Kim, she who now cooks lunch for Gary. This green sock belongs to him. Every sock can tell a story, they have ambitions of their own. When I'm out with 2 old favourites, sometimes one does not come home. On my left foot there's a white sock, on my right foot there's a blue. Even though they smell somewhat, they make me think of you and you. People say odd socks is crazy. People say I'm weird. People say I've lost my marbles. Well, I haven't. I've got them here. I've got 47 marbles, including 11 pairs. Lovers, come and roll my marbles. Move on and leave me theirs. There's my odd sock poem. And I did do, a few years ago, a museum of socks.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, where I had, like, you know... the socks used by Alexander the Great, and and I had a team of mad knitters creating these. And, my sock museum, I was quite proud of that. And I did also, for 2 years, I did Archer Art, which was it was a kind of art exhibition, but with an aim to make people laugh, because I always thought you never seem to hear laughter in an art gallery, do you?
No.
So I wanted to make people laugh, and I had all sorts, and I had lots of submissions from comedians and ridiculous paintings, and I've still got a few of them at home somewhere.
Amazing.
Maybe I should revive my art and sock museum and gallery.
Do.
If anyone's listening, I've still got most of the socks and quite a few of the art things. I remember Janie Godley did a painting, and Stuart Lee created a bit of art for me. I don't know what happened to them all. I think they all disappeared into a garage in Essex, never to be seen again, as happens.
Well, I've just moved into a new place, and so if you have any art that I can decorate.
Yeah, well, I'll go and, well, yeah, they'll all be back in London now. I didn't bring any of them up with me, I don't think. Although I have got an enormous sock somewhere that would be enough to fit a 17-foot man, or woman, come to that.
Yeah, equal opportunities.
Yeah, that's right. Or day or whatever, you know.
Absolutely.
If you're 17 foot tall, these socks are for you.
You've got the marketing down solidly.
Yeah, no, I never made any money out of the socks or the art. So I did sell a couple of pictures, actually, that I dimly remember. I had one that was Sorry I Broke Your Vase. Made out of the fragments of a vase I'd broken. I've got one at home. If anyone wants to buy it, £400.
A bargain.
Yeah.
You can spread the costs, right?
Yeah, you can have £50 if someone writes in and says No one writes in anywhere, obviously, anymore. Tweets in or
pigeon.
Well, I might have a banana in a minute.
The tension now is unbearable.
Yeah, I'm looking at that banana.
You've got croissants, you've got banana.
It's a bit late for a croissant. Do you know what I want?
You used to live in Paris. Oysters. It's never too late for a croissant.
Yeah, you're right.
Where's your francophileness gone now?
Oui, t'as raison. C'est jamais trop tard pour un croissant. Je vais en manger un plus tard, je crois.
Quelle est la date de ton anniversaire?
Ah, très bien. Alors, tu parles bien le français, hein? Comment ça?
Combien de pantalons et le papillon?
Très bien.
Zut alors.
Oh là là, merde alors. Putain de bordel de merde. As I used to say in Paris when I was there. I don't know, probably different swearing these days. That one means, what was it? Putain de bordel. Whore of the brothel. Putain de bordel de no, whore of the brothel of your mother, or something that used to mean, which I don't think we should be saying now.
No, it's referring to a family business.
Yeah. Yeah, some kind of Instagram account or TikTok, yeah.
TikTok.
Yeah.
Your sock exhibition, you've referred to Malcolm Hardy before. You were nominated or won the Malcolm Hardy Award for the sock exhibition?
I think I might have done, yeah. I can't keep track. I certainly won it for some other thing, for publicity, when I was doing a show one year and I didn't really want any critics to come. So I said they could only come if they paid £100 and came on stage and juggled fish. And one critic did do that. So I won some of what Malcolm Hardy won. Maybe the Sox won the Malcolm Hardy Award, I don't know. I mean, obviously Malcolm Hardy's dead, so...
spoiler alert.
He doesn't judge them. It's, I think, John Fleming who keeps his flame burning.
The Fleming flame.
Yeah.
It was the Cunning Stunt Award. I think you won for that.
Was it? Yeah, good.
I had to practice before this interview several times. Yeah. I don't know if Ofcom regulate podcasts, but they're touch and go.
Yeah, you'll probably get it. Well, it's good. If you get sued, that can be good for publicity.
That's true. Or arrested, as we all know.
Yeah, arrested's even better.
Yeah. It might affect the DBS check for the teaching gig, but apart from that.
Are you teaching?
I'm a primary school teacher.
Ah, that's what I remember you saying now, yeah. Oh, well done you. That's a wonderful job.
Oh, thank you very much.
My partner's mother was a primary school teacher, and she's just so understanding of children, and she's just such a... Because you've really got to understand them and empathise, haven't you, to look after them like that. Well done, Dom.
Oh, thank you. It's a huge pleasure, because it's their... I always describe it as like some of Britain's foremost surrealist comic minds, because the creative ideation,
absolutely,
produce, and it's unjaded, unsort of it's got to be like this shape.
No, yeah, yeah. There's no rules or regulations. They just think things up, and I'm sure they're quite inspiring in a way. Yeah,
totally. And it seems the trait that you've managed to keep from childhood, because to go from socks to Hamlet to ballet dancers falling off a mountain to
getting arrested.
Exactly.
Well, I hope none of your pupils were arrested, but yes. Well, that used to be a big thing, doesn't it? Keeping in touch with your inner child, and you don't hear that phrase much anymore. Or do you? But that was a big thing at one time, wasn't it? I think I've never really grown up, to be honest. I'm still about 8 or 9. I think the best age is probably 6. That's before you realise that you're going to... I think at that age, is it? What age is it children realise they're going to die and that everyone's going to die?
Depends how well behaved they are in the lesson.
How many have you killed, Tom? Admit it. No, I loved being 6. I was in the mischief gang, and we had my joke was that our leader Raymond was so tough his contribution to the nature table was a dead dog. They still have nature tables in schools.
They've graduated to forest school now, so you go out to a forest and you will see it in real life.
Yeah. I mean, you can travel a lot more easily now. You know, I grew up in Southwark Park Primary School. I went to. I don't know if that's still there, but that was in the post-war, so it was quite an austere era. And there were bomb sites everywhere when I was growing up.
What, a school visit? So you go and visit the doodle bug?
Yeah, well, it was the best playground you could imagine, a bomb site. It was much more interesting than a park. You never knew what you were going to find, you know, an old bone or a hand grenade or something.
IED.
Yeah, it was exciting, but I think it's probably for the best. There aren't too many bomb sites now, and let's hope there won't be any arriving soon.
I think it's a cause we can all get behind.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a controversial statement. You're not going to be cancelled over that.
Yeah, there's probably a few bomb sightings in Ukraine now. I went to see the Ukrainian National Ballet last night. That was pretty amazing.
I've heard only fantastic things about it.
Yeah, well, it's not like anything I'd ever seen before, and it's quite hard to make out what the plot is, but they're all so athletic, and there's loads of great costumes and cupboards and music, obviously. It was quite inspiring, and especially you think, God, what have they been through to get here? And, you know, we have it easy, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be a hard gear shift to my next question from that.
Yeah, well, we'll make this near one of the last two questions, because I really want to go and find some oysters soon, Dom, I'll warn you.
Okay, I will quickly cut down to the last three questions then.
Yeah, I would do longer if you like. If you really want, I will, but I've just started thinking about oysters.
Could we, like, 15 minutes?
Go on.
Okay. The question I was going to say is... you're a big fan of Jane Austen, I've discovered. And you tweeted recently that you feel like she would have made a great stand-up. What do you like about Jane Austen? Why do you think she would have done well on the circuit?
Because she's so witty and so understanding of women and how, you know, the hard thing it was being female then. Well, it's still harder than being male, I think. And the way she put her plots together. And I remember reading him when I was about 15 or something, and just think they were really erotic, actually, Jane Austen novels, just because you sort of knew there was all this jostling and who was going to get off with who, and so witty. I remember I went to the Jane Austen Museum in Bath, although Jane Austen never really liked Bath, but they really kind of plug themselves around Jane Austen in Bath.
Yeah.
And and the guide was talking about Jane Austen, and there was an Australian bloke there, and then he said, and the guide said, and then sadly, Jane Austen died at the age of 42, and the Australian went, "Oh no, poor Jane," and burst into tears. Oh, yeah, Jane Austen, I think, and the Brontes too. I once stayed in Haworth, in the museum up there of where they used to live, the Priory. And that was an amazing trip as well, a visit, and seeing all the little notes they sent to each other in the pictures. And then the sad thought, they all died before their father did. Must have been hard for him, poor man. There were four of them, with the brother who died young of drinking himself to death, which is sort of obviously an option in life that some people take.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's pick up the energy from there.
Oh, that was nice. A bit of silence.
It was.
That's one of the things I do in my show, then, as you'll have seen. Mm. I like to experiment with silence, because obviously it doesn't. People find it difficult on the radio or even in real life, where you suddenly have a silence. yeah, I've broken the silence.
I would have stretched as long as you'd have. We used up the 15 minutes of silence.
Yeah.
that's an art project in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, silence. Obviously, there's the famous. Was it Nicholas?
The 4 minutes something.
Yeah, which is just silence. Yeah. People don't really consider silence very much, especially in the world of comedy.
Mm.
I mean, if there's just silence, it's generally deemed to be a failure. That's one thing about comedy, is that your success or otherwise is measured immediately and audibly, which is not true of any other art form, really, because you'd be watching a play, but you know you don't know if the audience are really enjoying it or not particularly. But obviously, if it's a comedy and they're all hooting with laughter, then it's going well. And if it's silence, then oh dear.
What's something you've learned about stand-up comedy in your decades of career that you wish you'd known at the start? That you could tell the 20-year-old Arthur Smith?
I think I'm going to tell him that you can be a bit more personal now. Or maybe that's just now. I mean, there are a lot of shows, aren't there, about where people investigate their various mental problems and whatnot, whereas, you know, in those days, you wouldn't ever reveal too much about yourself.
Mm.
I noticed there was it three or four shows this year about comedians who've got ADHD,
mm-hmm.
which it turns out pretty much every comedian's got
mm-hmm.
or may have. I think I understand that, and I think maybe I have too. It goes with comedy somehow, a certain impulsiveness. A certain risk, you don't mind taking risks, and you're a bit chaotic. And
a constant high energy and sort of idea.
Yeah.
And so that naturally would feed creativity, presumably, if you just have 1,000 thoughts, chances are some of those are going to be
Exactly.
Good.
I mean, it's not very good if you want to be an accountant, probably, because you're probably going to run around the office banging a tray on your head rather than getting down with the accounts.
Which was, of course, your first show at the Fringe.
Yeah, we were an act called the Canalettolones, and we used to wear leopard skin nappies and run around stage shouting in Italian and banging our heads with trays and doing forward rolls.
Dada-esque.
Yeah. I'm a big Dada man. I've always been interested in Dadaism. Most people don't even know what it is these days, but it was like the sort of parent of surrealism.
Mm.
And it all happened. I've been there to the Cabaret Voltaire in Zurich, where it all started in 1915, when this bunch of disparate people put on a ridiculous show. And the absurdism.
Yeah.
That was the birth of absurdism, because the whole, you know, what had come before, classicism and everything else, had led to this awful First World War.
Definitely.
So people thought, well, you know, it might be better if we did just silly stuff. And I'm always intrigued by Zurich in 1915, because that's where everyone went who was trying to escape the war, because that was neutral then.
Mm.
So you had apart from the Dadaists, James Joyce was living there at the time.
Wow.
And Lenin, as well, was living in Zurich in 1950. It often makes me wonder if they ever went to the Dada shows.
Well, there's your next play, similar to the Steve Martin, he wrote a play about, I think, the Dali meeting Van Gogh or something in a cafe.
Oh, yeah.
Follow-up to An Evening with Gary Lineker.
Yeah.
Is Lennon and...
Well, except I think Tom Stoppard's already done it.
Has he now?
Yeah. I think he wrote a play based around those facts that I think he did. You'll have to look that one up.
I will do.
But if he hasn't, then I'll do it.
Yeah, jump in there. We've spoken a little bit about it before, but poetry is a big part of your life and a big part of your career too.
Yes.
From earliest days, 2-1 BA in comparative literature from UEA, where you were chairman of the Poetry Society.
Yeah.
Why do you love poetry so much?
Because poetry expresses in the most eloquent way emotion and feeling, and it's the order of the words make it something very different from prose. Mm. And the most powerful statements somehow come in poetry. It's like when someone dies, people always want to write a poem. And poetry, interestingly, is a bit like stand-up in that you have to have the words in the right order. You just change them around a little bit and it doesn't quite work. You find that with stand-up, you'll have a punchline and you just have to slightly twist the words around order a little bit and it'll get a laugh in a way that it didn't before. Mm. And poetry's like that. What was it that Wordsworth said? It's poetry is the... what did Wordsworth say? I'm a bit knackered. The overflowing of emotion and blah blah blah. Something said something really good. But I've always been moved by poetry, perhaps because of my ADHD, because poetry is shorter than a novel or than an opera, and a good poem will elevate you in its eloquence. So I used to learn poetry in order to impress girls. That was partly it. When I was at that age at school, it was quite a common thing for people to learn poetry. They'd say your homework was to go home and learn a poem. Mm. And having learned them, I still learn them by heart in order to, partly to impress people, but partly because to say a poem sometimes is the best way to finish a show or to change the direction or the emotions of a show. Mm. So I've got a kind of handful that I know by heart that I often put into, if I'm doing a longer set, sort of 45 minutes or so,
yeah.
I'll often put a poem in, some occasionally by me, but usually ones that I've learnt by other people. And I'm always, audiences are pleased to hear them, I find.
Yeah.
I've got a good one to end on when we get to the end. So you can, when you cue that, we'll make that the last bit. Well, I'll end on a poem, as I like to do.
Is this sometimes?
No, but yes, but I said I'd do that, didn't I? Yeah.
Well, if you can do both.
I'll do both. I'll happily do both.
Fantastic. Well, why don't we have the mystery poem first, then end with sometimes, or would you prefer the other way around?
They're both good to end on, to be honest.
We can do them back to back if you want. How do you produce this?
I think I'll do sometimes first.
Okay.
Because, and then the other one...
later on at the end.
Yeah, all right. I'll do sometimes for you now. Now, I didn't write this poem.
Okay.
No, I know you think I did, but it was written by a woman called Sheena Pugh, who is actually a bit... Because it became a very popular poem at one point.
Yeah.
I think it was even used at the signing of the North Ireland Agreement. Anyway.
Okay.
And she's a bit, it's a bit like, oh yeah, they're always going on about sometimes, what about all my other poems? So I recommend you, if you want to go and read some other poems. But I hope, Sheena, if you're listening to this, you'll forgive me for doing it again. And for saying that you wrote it. She doesn't mind if I say it without mentioning her. Anyway, I'll shut up.
We'll have her on the show and she can give her side of it.
Yeah, fair enough. She lives up in the Shetlands or somewhere.
Okay.
Anyway, Sometimes by Sheena Pugh. Sometimes things don't go after all from bad to worse. Some years muscatel faces down frost. Green thrives, the crops don't fail. Sometimes a man aims high and all goes well. A people will sometimes step back from war, elect an honest man. Decide they care enough, they cannot leave some stranger poor. Some men become what they were born for. Sometimes our best efforts do not go amiss. Sometimes we do as we meant to. The sun will sometimes melt a field of sorrow that seemed hard frozen. May it happen for you.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful poem.
Yeah, it really is a lovely poem. I'm going to have a slurp of coffee now.
Yes, you've earned it. Mm. When you were saying about how good it feels to recite poetry, there's in Michelle Brazier's show, Average Bear, that we were talking about before. She has a line in it about how singing and crying are very similar for her because there's a nerve that hugs your heart when you sing.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that's a similar thing for poetry, that it has this genuine almost sort of chemical reaction to recitation of it.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I'm just going to see Michelle's show.
It's really good.
What's her surname again, Michelle?
Brazier.
Brazier.
She's coming on the show too.
Oh, good. Yeah, well, say hello to her from me.
I will do. I'll end with this question. Why do we need stories?
Because that's the way we can begin to understand the world. Religion is just stories, but some people adhere to them so much that they become a kind of truth and not a story. But stories is how we understand the world, and stories is how we stop ourselves being too oppressed by the world. We need stories. Every human being needs a story, and every human being needs a laugh sometimes. So I feel very privileged that I can bring storytelling and laughter together, which are two of the fundamental things in life that keep us going. Laughter is the one true metaphysical consolation. And I always loved that Danish comedian who said, I've forgotten his name, damn it, laughter is the shortest distance between two people. Mm. And so stories and laughter is how we keep going in the world and how we try and understand the world, because it's incomprehensible, really, if you look too closely. But if you invent a story that brings things together, then you can find meaning.
Amazing. I have no glib segue from that other to say.
Well, in that case, I'll go for the finishing poem, shall I?
Please do.
Yeah, this was written in 1650 by John Dryden, who was the first ever poet laureate. And it's a poem, I like to say, at the end of a day, when you got through the day, you had some good little moments, you didn't do any harm, and it was your day. It's called Happy the Man by John Dryden in 1650. Happy the man, and happy he alone. He who can call today his own. He who, secure within, can say, tomorrow do thy worst, for I have lived today. Be fair or foul, or rain or shine, the joys I have possessed, in spite of fate, are mine. Not heaven itself upon the past has power, but what has been, and I have had my hour. Well, more like me 45 minutes.
Arthur Smith, thank you so much for talking to me
Dom,
today.
Dom, a pleasure to speak to you, and keep going with looking after those little kids. Well done, mate.
Thank you so much.